Okay, so we were in the middle of reading the life of St. Anthony. This is, I think we've read it two sessions now. This would be the third. And we're right in the middle of, there's this long speech that he gives that was written down. So it's number 17 there. So if we just kind of go back to see where we were. It says here, you know, we were reading how he spent 20 years living in this fort. People would bring him a bunch of dried bread and other things like that once every 6 months. As a total aside, that has nothing to do with this. When we hear about how these saints lived off of dried bread alone, we think, how is that possible? They wouldn't have enough nutrition. Well, that's because the varieties of wheat that we have now, of course, are totally different than the varieties of wheat that they had 1700 years ago, and so you actually could live off just wheat because it was a more complex food than it is now. Anyway, total aside, but anyway, so he would live basically off of dried bread that was brought to him every few months, and he was living inside this abandoned fort in the middle of the desert. And of course, the big thing with Saint Anthony is that he was not the first monk. He was the first to go and live totally out in the desert. And then also he ended up, as we see here, he ended up living there, and then people began to want to live out there with him. And so we hear about how it says the desert was colonized by monks. Who came forth from their own people and enrolled themselves for their citizenship in the heavens. So Saint Anthony was after living as a hermit for many years, he was now bringing people, I think at this time he would have been about 55 or 60. At this time, then people started coming and living there. So it says he addressed them in Coptic, which is the original language of Egypt. And it says that because this was written in Greek. And just to review, this was written by St. Athanasius, who then became a disciple of St. Anthony later. But this whole speech he gave to the monks one day was recorded and written down. So we had just started it, and here we were on number 17. So Matt, why don't you start us off reading that paragraph there?
Sure. Wherefore, children, let us not faint nor deem that the time is long, or that we are doing something great. For the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory which shall be revealed to us. Romans 8:18.
We actually did read this last time, but it's fine. Let's just read it again, because I think it's where we ended. No, stop. Just read it again.
Nor let us think, as we look at the world, that we have renounced anything of much consequence. For the whole earth is very small compared with all the heaven. Wherefore, if it even chanced that we were lords of all the earth and gave it all up, it would be not worthy of comparison with the kingdom of heaven. For as if a man should despise a copper drachma to gain 100 drachmas of gold, so if a man were lord of all the earth and were to renounce it, that which he gives up is little, and he receives 100-fold. But if not even the whole earth is equal in value to the heavens, and he who has given up a few acres leaves as it were nothing, and even if he have given up a house or much gold, he ought not to boast nor be low-spirited. Further, we should consider that even if we do not relinquish them for virtue's sake, still afterwards, when we die, we shall leave them behind. Very often, as the preacher says, to those to whom we do not wish, why then should we not give them up for virtue's sake, that we may inherit even a kingdom? Therefore, let the desire of possession take hold for no one, for what gain is it to acquire these things which we cannot take with us? Why not rather get those things which we can take away with us, to wit, prudence, justice, temperance, courage, understanding, love, kindness to the poor, faith in Christ, freedom from wrath, hospitality? If we possess these, we shall find them of themselves preparing for us a welcome there in the land of the meek-hearted.
Okay, thank you. So I think we did read this. I think we ended on that paragraph last time, but it was 2 weeks ago, so it's good to review. And there's a really important point here. You know, that he's saying that to monks, and this applies to us too as Christians in general. He says, let us not think that we are doing something great. He says, nor let us think as we look at the world that we have renounced anything of much consequence. And so his point here is that, you know, for us as Christians, and especially for them as Christians who are monks, but even for us, you know, we shouldn't think, oh, I'm giving up so much to be a Christian. You know, I'm giving up, you know, eating whatever I want all the time because we fast, right? Or I'm giving up partying or whatever people in the world do, right? Because I'm a Christian, you know. We're not really giving up much, you know. And for them as monks, you know, they give up owning property. That's part of being a monk. But he's saying, you know, what is it to give up, you know, owning a few acres or owning a house or something like that? That's not a, you know, compared to the whole world, that's nothing, you know. And compared to what the life we're going to inheriting with eternal life, this is all nothing. So we shouldn't think that we're doing something great by being Christians or by being monks. But this is just, you know, what we're renouncing is just kind of temporary things anyway.
I feel like he's saying don't, you know, don't be prideful about it, more or less, to, you know, as an easy summary.
Yeah.
If we're calling it out, then are we really being
right?
Christian?
I'm doing something.
You know, yeah. I'm awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was looking at something else, and there was a documentary kind of thing that I saw where this nun was saying, you know, that as monastics, as in her experience as a nun, that's the most important thing, and that applies to every Christian as well. That it's how did she say it? She said it was something like, it's better to have like painful self-awareness than to like pray for many hours a day or something like that. You know, so this idea that it's more important to be humble than to do anything else, or to get rid of pride and really like be honest with yourself is really the most important thing. And that's painful, but it's more important than anything else.
I suppose that makes sense, because if you're aware of that, then you can humble yourself to,
yeah,
you know.
Well, that's the original sin, right? And this, and they say this too about when they talk about demons, right? They say, you know, the demons fast all the time. They never eat anything. You know, they do this and that. All the, you know, they can whatever. But
they know the Bible better than forward.
They know the Bible much better than we do. Even better than Pentecostals or whatever. Yeah. So it's the attitude is what matters. Yeah. So, all right, so chapter 18, Sarah, could you read that?
Sure. And so from such things let a man persuade himself not to make light of it, especially if he considers that he himself is the servant of the Lord and ought to serve his master. Wherefore, as a servant would not dare to say, because I worked yesterday, I will not work today, and considering the past will do no work in the future, but as it is written in the gospel, daily shows the same readiness to please his master and to avoid risk. So let us daily abide firm in our discipline, knowing that if we are careless for a single day, the Lord will not pardon us for the sake of the past, but will be wrath against us for our neglect. As also we have heard in Ezekiel, and as Judas, because of one night, destroyed his previous labor.
So yeah, that sounds like a bit of a harsh saying to say, God, you know, God will not pardon us if we're careless for one day. But I think what he's saying, you know, is that whatever spiritual progress you have, you can lose that in one day. You know, you can lose that in one day, just like Judas was a disciple for 3 years and then lost that in, you know, well, in his case, 2 days, Wednesday to Friday. You know, he lost all that. And, you know, and so this is always a very important thing to keep in mind, that we shouldn't become comfortable. And they talked about this earlier. St. Anthony himself in his own life thought this as well. But, you know, we shouldn't just kind of, oh, I'll just take a day off of, you know, saying any prayers or anything like that. It's not good, because that can quickly spiral out of control.
Was it C.S. Lewis or somebody, I don't think it was somebody Orthodox, that said basically we're never really static in our spiritual life. We're either moving closer to or farther away from God?
Yeah, he probably said something like that. I've heard many different variations of that. Yeah, I mean.
Oh, I'm definitely paraphrasing.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's, yeah, you can't. Well, because if we sit, like, if we, there's not really, like, a neutral position
yeah.
you can have. You're either with God or you're against God. It's not a, it's not kind of a neutral, it's not much that's neutral. Yeah.
Wasn't Judas stealing from their, like, donation box prior in the training?
Yeah, it does say that, yeah. So maybe that's not the best example, but that's what he said, though. But that being said, you know, there is also there are also examples of this in the lives of the saints. You know, people, and we, as we read about earlier, we have those people who are Christians, and they came forward and they said, "I'm going to be martyred. Martyr me." And then when it came to it, then they were like, "Oh, actually, I'm not going to be martyred," and they sacrificed to the Caesar. So it was just kind of, you know, one day you can kind of undo all of your progress.
Father, can I ask
yeah.
a question? I was actually
yeah.
wondering about this just very recently. So, you know, the Gospels talk about how the disciples went out and they, you know, they healed people and they cast out demons and
yeah.
all these things. I mean,
yeah.
can we assume that Judas was doing these things too?
I think so.
Okay.
I've thought about that before, too, yeah. I think so, yeah.
Okay.
I think it says he was with them when they did that.
Yeah, I guess I don't know. Like, if he had done, like,
yeah,
zero things for 3, like, after, like, do they have waited 3 years, or would they have kicked him out of the group before that? I mean, I know that's not how it goes, but...
Yeah, well, it seems like that comment about him stealing out of the money box is, like, I forget which gospel that is, but the way that the evangelist says it, he says it, like... It was something that nobody knew about, basically, right? Like, the other disciples didn't... Like, the way that he says it, it seems that it's... He says it as kind of like a... Oh, because he used to do this, but it's kind of implied that nobody really knew he was doing that. But I mean, not that matters, but... Yeah, no, I think he definitely... Judas definitely was there when they were going out and casting out demons and all that, because that's right after Christ. It says Christ calls the 12 to him, and then right after that, then he says, go and do this. And,
okay.
You know, yeah. That's in the Gospel of Luke, I think, that specific sequence. All right. So this is where we are at 19. Matthew, could you read that?
Wherefore, children, let us hold fast our discipline, and let us not be careless. For in it the Lord is our fellow worker, as it is written. To all that choose the good, God works with them for good. But to avoid being heedless, it is good to consider the word of the apostle, I day daily. 1 Corinthians 15:31. For if we too live as though dying daily, we shall not sin. And the meaning of that saying is that as we rise day by day, we should think that we shall not abide till evening. And again, when about to lie down to sleep, we should think that we shall not rise up. For our life is naturally uncertain, and providence allots it to us daily. But thus ordering our daily life, we shall neither fall into sin, nor have a lust for anything, nor cherish wrath against any, nor shall we heap up treasure upon earth. But as though under the daily expectation of death, we shall be without wealth, and shall forgive all things to all men, nor shall we retain at all the desire of women or any other foul pleasure. But we shall turn from it as past and gone, ever striving and looking forward to the day of judgment. For the greater dread and danger of torment ever destroys the ease of pleasure and sets up the soul if it is like to fall.
Okay, so again, we have to remember he's speaking to monks specifically. He's not speaking to everybody. So he says, you know, some of these things sound a little bit extreme for us. But again, we apply them to us as we can. So, you know, we shouldn't go through life thinking I'm going to die today every single day. But what he's saying is that as though under the daily expectation of death, meaning, you know, we should always be living in a way that we are, that, you know, God forbid, if we were to die in some sort of accident, we would be comfortable with how we're living. And, you know, a way to not live like this, right, is you can say, I'll go and do whatever sin, and then I can, like, go confess it later or something, you know. you know, which is not really a way to live, of course. So it's really important though. Every day we shouldn't give ourselves excuses and say, oh, I'll do such and such sin just this one time, or just today, or I'll do, you know, I won't say my prayers today, blah, blah, blah. And you know, we all do that all the time, but we shouldn't be doing that. You know, we should be living in a way like we're, we are, as if, as though, as he says, as though, you know, we're prepared to die at any moment. Not in a morbid way, but in just the kind of, this is how we should be living. Nice long paragraph.
Don't make Clint read it.
I know. Yeah. I'll just make Clint read the long ones.
It's fine if you want to.
Okay. All right, Clint, you can read 20.
Okay. Wherefore, having already begun and set out in the way of virtue, let us strive the more that we may attain those things that are before. And let no one turn to the things behind, like Lot's wife, all the more so that the Lord has said, no man, having put his hand to the plow and turning back, is fit for the kingdom of heaven. And this turning back is not else but to feel regret and to be once more worldly minded. But fear not to hear of virtue, nor be astonished at the name, for it is not far from us, nor is it without ourselves, but it is within us, and is easy if only we are willing. That they may get knowledge, the Greeks live abroad and cross the sea, but we have no need to depart from home for the sake of the kingdom of heaven, nor to cross the sea for the sake of virtue. For the Lord aforetime has said, the kingdom of heaven is within you. Wherefore virtue has need at our hands of willingness alone, since it is in us and it is formed from us. For when the soul has its spiritual faculty in a natural state, virtue is formed. And it is in a natural state when it remains as it came into existence. And when it came into existence, it was fair and exceeding honest. For this cause, Joshua, the son of Nun, in his exhortation said to the people, make straight your heart unto the Lord God of Israel, and John, make your paths straight, for rectitude of soul consists in its having its spiritual part in its natural state as created. But on the other hand, when it swerves and turns away from its natural state, that is called vice of the soul. Thus the matter is not difficult. If we abide as we have been made, we are in a state of virtue. But if we think of ignoble things, we shall be accounted evil. If therefore this thing had to be acquired from without, it would be difficult in reality. But if it is in us, let us keep ourselves from foul thoughts. And as we have received the soul as a deposit, let us preserve it for the Lord, that he may recognize his work as being the same as he made it.
Thank you. I'm just trying to understand that last sentence a little bit. Last two sentences. So if we go back to the beginning of this paragraph, no, we don't turn to the things that are behind, like Lot's wife, which, you know, we understand that as what that stands for is that, you know, if you look at the things that are behind, then you're like remembering worldly things, which we shouldn't really be thinking about. And so, you know, he talks about how the kingdom of heaven is within you here. He says, we have no need to depart from home for the sake of the kingdom of heaven or to cross the sea. The kingdom of heaven is within you. This is a really important concept. When I went to Mount Athos a few years ago, which, you know, is this place in Greece where there's thousands of monks who live in this area, very rugged mountainous area, and different monasteries there, you know, a saying that they have all the time there, because they've all these people come and visit these monasteries, these monks, and they say, everyone's like, wow, it's so amazing here. And then the monks are always like, it's not the place that saves, right? And so everybody thinks like, oh, if I just came and lived here, like, I would become a saint. And it's like, no, you don't become a saint. You become more aware of your sinfulness, right? Because you're so focused on this life. That's again, this is what people always say about becoming Orthodox, is that you just become more aware of your sinfulness. It's not about becoming, you don't see yourself as more virtuous or anything, but you're struggling to be virtuous, and in that struggle you see that you're not virtuous. But that's okay, because as Christ said, the kingdom of heaven is within you. And so we don't need to go any specific place. We come to church, but even as we saw St. Anthony, he didn't go to church for 20 years. He lived alone in a fort for 20 years. Because, you know, the kingdom of heaven is within you, and you pray within you. This is, of course, something that's very important in the Orthodox tradition, is this idea of praying internally, praying, no matter what we're doing, driving, you know, walking, whatever, we can pray. It's a very good thing to do.
Praying without ceasing.
Praying without ceasing. That's how St. Paul says it. Praying without ceasing, which then in the tradition is taken up as either repeating the Jesus prayer or some other prayers internally all the time. So at some of these monasteries that I visited in Greece, the monks will, just when they're walking around all the time, they're just praying. You can hear them praying under their breath. Which you might think, like, is that, it's not something like a mantra or something like in Hinduism or something like that, but they're actually praying in the sense that prayer is communication with God. Just like when we pray in church, it's the same thing. And he says, as he says here too, you know, we, our soul, in having its spiritual part in its natural state, is created. So in our natural state is virtuous, and then foul thoughts, suggestions, those kinds of things come to us. And we heard this before. It said when St. Anthony was, when he had become full of the Holy Spirit after 20 years, he was wholly rational, it said. So it's really important for us to remember that the natural state that we are supposed to be in is not how we are now, right? The state that we're in now is not really the natural state. It's the state of us being subject to sin and passions and these temptations and things like that. And what we're doing is we're working to rid ourselves of those things to get to our natural state, which is a virtue. This is what the saints talk about, later saints as well, like Saint Gregory of Nyssa. He talks about how, you know, we're made in the image of God, and that's in some part that's not even, and different church fathers talk about this differently, but some church fathers, when they talk about the image of God, that's not even referring to anything bodily at all, but it's referring to your mind in a sense, because your mind is what either is virtuous or is not virtuous, so we try to return to that state of virtue that we were created in when God created us in his image. All right, 21. Nathan, could you read that?
And let us strive that wrath rule us not, nor must overcome us. For it is written, the wrath of man works not the righteousness of God, and lust, when it has conceived, bears a sin, and the sin, when it has full grown, brings forth death. Thus living, let us keep God carefully, and as it is written, keep our hearts with all watchfulness. For we have terrible and crafty foes, the evil spirits, and against them we wrestle, as the apostle said, not against flesh and blood, but against the principalities, and against the powers, and against the world rulers of the darkness, against the spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places. Great is the number in the air around us, and they are not far from us. now they are great distinctions among them, and concerning their nature and distinctions, much could be said, but such a description is for others of greater powers than we possess. But at this time, it is pressing and necessary for us only to know the will miles against ourselves.
Thank you. So again, this is something that we really need to keep in mind, you know, that it's actually something I think that's very, very helpful. Is that, you know, if you're thinking about sinning, just remember that there's a bunch of demons who are like, yeah, we want this guy to sin, you know, and they want to do that because they're wrestling against you. So it's very good to keep in mind these evil spirits. This is a real thing. And a lot of modern Christianity, they really de-emphasize these satanic, demonic, the devils. We need to be very clear that we should not do that. But this is, you know, very much a reality. You know, as St. Paul, that quote from St. Paul, we do not struggle against flesh and blood, but against the principalities, against the powers. Against the world rulers of this darkness, against the spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places. Of course, that doesn't make us afraid either, because there's also much greater spiritual hosts of God, angelic hosts that are, that are for us, and so that's very good. Yeah. So he says that this time is pressing and necessary for us only to know their wiles against ourselves. It's like Wile E. Coyote, the wiles. Don't see that word too often. Yeah, Nathan.
When he says principalities and powers, is he referring to like angels? I know with like Catholicism, like those different like angels.
The ranks of angels, yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if you do Orthodox believe that.
Because yeah. That's also from St. Paul.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So sometimes when he says principalities and powers, he's talking about angels, and sometimes when he says principalities and powers, he's talking about demons. Because there's this belief that they're the ranks of angels, but there's also a belief that the demons fell out of those ranks as well.
I should have said fallen angels. That's what I meant to say. Yeah.
Oh yeah, but there's also out of the angels, there's also ranks of angels, as we talk about principalities, powers, and all these, and so the same terms are used because, they're fallen from those same ranks in a sense. Yeah. Where are we? Yeah, 23. Can you see?
I said, yeah, as people lowering this in here.
I could read it earlier. I don't know.
It is not long to read.
You want to use it?
No,
he's right out.
First, therefore, we must go to this. That the demons have not been created like we mean when we call them by that name. For God made nothing evil, but even they have been made good. Having fallen, however, from the heavenly wisdom, since then they have been groveling on earth. On the one hand, they deceive the Greeks with their displays, while out of envy of us Christians, they move all things in their desire to hinder us from entry into the heaven, in order that we should not ascend up there from whence they fell. Thus there is need of much prayer and of discipline, that when a man has received through the Spirit the gift of discerning spirits, he may have power to recognize their characteristics, which of them are less and which more evil, of what nature is the special pursuit of each, and how each of them is overthrown and cast out. For their villainies and the changes in their plots are many. The blessed apostle and his followers knew such things when they said, for we are not ignorant of his devices. And we, from the temptations we have suffered at their hands, ought to correct one another under them. Wherefore I, having had proof of them, speak as to children.
Okay, thank you. So this is an interesting point here that he's making. He says, he says the demons were not created evil, for God made nothing evil, but even then they've been made good. However, fallen from heavenly wisdom, since they have been groveling on earth. So they're on earth and they're doing wicked things. And so on one hand, they deceive the Greeks, meaning the pagans. When they say Greeks at this time, it means pagans. On the one hand, they deceive the pagans with their displays, while out of envy of us Christians, they move all things in their desire to hinder us from entry into the heavens, in order that we should not ascend up there from whence they fell. St. Athanasius, who's the one writing this down and then later writes his own works that were very important in the early church. St. Athanasius, and he has a work about this too, where he talks about, why is it that the demons did all this activity in the idols? And, when we talk about, in the Old Testament, there's these cults of Moloch and stuff where they have them sacrificing children and burning people alive and all this stuff. And, why were these demons doing all this activity very openly previously, and now they don't? And we could say still now they don't. And it's at St. Athanasius' time in the 4th century AD, he said, well, because of the coming of Christ, they've kind of changed their strategy, right? So previously, the demonic powers ruled over people through these shows of whatever they would do, showing things like that, showing signs and things like that. Like he says, displays. But now they have a different strategy, which is, to suggest things and use thoughts and much more that strategy. And of course, now in modernity, we see that the strategy too for the demons is also to suggest that they don't exist at all. Right? It's a very productive strategy to say, oh, well, the world is purely material and there's no spiritual reality at all. And of course, that's a very popular thing to believe nowadays. But we would say that's also, it's just kind of a further evolution. When we talk about the demons are not smart, but they have lots of experience. So they kind of change their strategy depending on how things are going. And we saw that with St. Anthony's own life, where they changed their strategy. At first they tried to scare him, and then different things. Yeah. Yes?
So they changed their strategy because of Christ, but why exactly? Because most of the world isn't Christian. So.
Well, in St. Athanasius' time, most of the world that they knew about within that sphere of the Mediterranean had become Christian by the middle of the 4th century. Many of them were Arians, but they were still Christians. So when he's writing that, he's saying that basically the demons don't try this, because then the church is able to cast them out and dissolve their power and things like that. And so they kind of shift their strategy in a sense. This is also why he also, I think it's him as well, they also talk about why were there so many miracles in the early church, but there are less now. And again, he's writing in the 4th century, not now, so it's interesting. But again, it's tied with the same idea, right? Is that, well, because there was all this demonic power active in all these pagan cults, there were many miracles taking place with the apostles and things like that. And then as time went on, there was less of a need for miracles. That's how it is. But. Yeah. Nick.
Well, what's interesting is that you still have people who actually make mock sacrifices to Moloch nowadays. Have you heard about Bohemian Grove?
Yes.
Yeah, that's Moloch.
Probably is, yeah.
But
a lot of the elite politicians and entertainers are into that stuff.
But yeah, they still
that's what
worship Moloch.
Yeah, and even in a less direct way, something like abortion is effectively the same thing, but in a different way. We see that these are people act like cults, even if they don't do any sort of cultic activity. They become possessed with the ideology of whatever. There are real pagan kind of things active. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
When you see the way some people act around abortions, like you said, it's like almost like a cult, you know.
And there's and there's all kinds of stuff like that. No, it is true. And of course, nowadays there are a lot of like neo-pagans and things like that nowadays, and people doing that stuff, and they really should not mess with that. There's a book, I don't know if any of you have read it, called Everyday Saints. Have you read that?
Halfway.
Yeah. So do you remember at the beginning, so it's written by a bishop who's now a very well-known bishop in Russia, but when he wrote the book, he was at that time a priest monk. But he wrote about his experience becoming a monk in the 1980s and right at the end of Soviet Russia. And there was this monastery. It was the only monastery that had stayed open the entire time throughout all of the Soviet period. And so they had all these old monks, and they're really fascinating characters. And he writes down about all the different monks who were living at this monastery. It's very, very interesting. And it was a very popular book. In Russia, it was like the bestseller on like their secular books, you know, out of any book, it was like the bestseller book. And it was translated in English and stuff. Anyway, so this bishop, how he became Christian, because he was growing up, you know, in atheist Russia in the 70s and 80s, he got into paganism, you know, and he started messing with some stuff, and he saw some things, and he got really freaked out, and then he went to a priest and became Christian, you know.
That's how I got into Orthodoxy. Was seeing some of the bad stuff.
And there's other people I know of as well. And it's very real. So, you know, so we really have to be careful about all that, obviously. But So then he says, you know, because of the demons, there's much need of prayer and discipline, that when a man has received through the Spirit the gift of discerning spirits, he may have the power to recognize their characteristics.
What's the point of like determining which demonic spirit is less or more evil, or the nature of the pursuit of each?
Well, this is what's interesting, right? Because we think about demons and we think they're all like super evil, but there are some weird things in Acts. There's that slave girl, it says, who has a demon, and she's going around and she's saying, "These men are servants of the Most High God." And then it says that St. Paul was annoyed, and so he cast out the demon. That's literally what it says. He was annoyed. I don't know if that was maybe the best translation, but that's what it usually says. What she's saying is true. What this demon is possessing this girl, and it's saying something that's true. So there's a sense that if you think about how the demons are all very proud and very selfish, then obviously they're not going to work as a team very well. So there must be some sense of sometimes they might be acting less evil, maybe just out of spite, despite other demons or something. I don't know. But there's that episode in Acts where that demon is saying things that are true, and then Paul casts it out. It's very interesting. But they're certainly not going to work well as a team if they're very, obviously they're very proud, and that's their main issue. Okay, so then let's go on to 23 here. Matt, could you read that?
"The demons, therefore, if they see all Christians and monks, especially laboring cheerfully in advancing, first make an attack by temptation and place hindrances to hamper our way, to wit, evil thoughts. But we need not fear their suggestions, for by prayer, fasting, and faith in the Lord, their attack immediately fails. But even when it does, they cease not. But navishly by subtly come on again. For when they cannot deceive the heart openly, with foul pleasures they approach in different guise, and thenceforth shaping displays they attempt to strike fear, changing their shapes, taking the forms of women, wild beasts, creeping things, gigantic bodies, and troops of soldiers. But not even then need you fear their deceitful displays, for they are nothing and quickly disappear, especially if a man fortify himself beforehand with faith and the sign of the cross. Yet are they bold and very shameless, for thus they are worsted, they make an onslaught in another manner, and pretend to prophecy and foretell the future. And and to show themselves of a height reaching to the roof and of great breadth, that they may stealthily catch by such displays those who could not be deceived by their arguments. If here also they find the soul strengthened by faith and a hopeful mind, then they bring their leader to their aid.
Okay. So he talks about, and we saw when we were reading his life, we saw this is exactly what he himself had experienced. And now here he's talking about it in this speech. So St. Anthony says, first they attack with evil thoughts, but these are put away by prayer, fasting, and faith. This idea of ceaseless prayer is very good when we have these evil thoughts, and we also can whatever, these are evil thoughts coming from the devil. It's important, too, that when we have, like, random evil thoughts in our head, that shouldn't cause us to get, like, low self-esteem or something. We shouldn't think poorly of ourselves, like, oh, I'm thinking this. Because these thoughts are not from us. Very often they're from demonic powers. Even if they appear to come from us, they're often not really from ourselves, from us, from within. And so we shouldn't fear any random evil thoughts or anything like that. But then he says, as we saw in his life, they take the forms of women or animals or soldiers or anything like that, and they try to scare you or entice you or whatever. But then this does not work either. And he says, especially if a man fortify himself beforehand with faith and the sign of the cross. So just as we cross ourselves like this, at that time they were already crossing themselves like this. This was a very early Christian custom. There's not any clear date as to when it started or anything like that, but obviously it's a very early practice. And he says they're bold and shameless, and then they try to prophesy and foretell the future. And of course, this is what people do when they go to like mediums and things like that. This is what, you know, palm reading and all that kind of stuff. This is what that is. You know, sometimes people are just charlatans, but sometimes they're actually working with demons. Again, this is also what they do. Now, can the demons tell the future? Well, they can't. But again, they've seen all of human history, and so they're very good at predicting things. but so sometimes it might seem like they can tell the future, but they can't really tell the future, of course. And then another aspect that would be with this too is Christ himself says, that Satan can appear as an angel of light, and so there's this idea that, we need to be aware of that as well. There are stories of this. I remember reading there was like a monk in the middle of the 20th century who, there was a supposed angel who was visiting him and telling him things, and the angel was telling him all these like things that seemed very like good and like what an angel would tell you. And then one day the angel was like, oh, jump off this cliff and I'll cut you. And then thankfully, like the monk's like elder, an angel came to him and was like, hey, this has been going on. And then he said, and then he went to this monk and he was like, have you been like talking with some demon or something? And he was like, oh yeah. So it was, yeah, it's in the life of Saint Joseph the Hesychast, who died in the 1950s. It was one of the monks who was living with him, I think, that happened to.
Father?
Yeah.
Are you able to elaborate at all about the sign of the cross, like the origin or like what kind of power it has, or can you like suggest any reading about that for people that want to learn more about it?
Well, you know, the cross, right, the idea of the cross is folly, as St. Paul says, right? It's something that it's supposed to be a symbol of weakness. It's supposed to be a symbol of torture, a symbol of weakness. It's the most shameful way to die possible, is to be, you're naked, publicly, you know, naked, nailed to a piece of wood, and it's designed in a way so that it's as painful as possible. Mm-hmm. Because as you see here, well, you can see it here, it's easier. As you see here, there's this little, on the Orthodox cross there, let's put this.
A footrest.
Which is the, it's a footrest at an angle.
Right.
Because it's an angled footrest so that you can't totally rest your feet on it. And so that allows you to it allows you to not die too fast. Because if you're just hung like this, eventually your rib cage will collapse. Mm-hmm. And that's how people would die when they were crucified. But they put that little footrest so that you would die slower, so that it was more painful.
That's because they were a master of torture.
Yeah, it was the most painful thing that they could come up with, basically. So for us, then, making the sign of the cross, it's the sign of victory, of Christ's victory. And I think when it comes specifically to the demons, they know that, right? By now, they know what's happened.
Right.
With Christ's victory on the cross. And so it's this symbol of Christ's power. And it's a symbol of power that's not of this world. Mm-hmm. Like Christ himself said, my kingdom is not of this world. And so it's a power that's a spiritual power, which then they recognize. And,
is this something that the church has always done, like from the very beginning? I mean, we don't
really, I really don't know.
It.
Yeah.
Do we know what the earliest references are to it?
So, I mean, St. Anthony is saying it just like it's a common thing that people do.
Right.
This is towards the end of, this is the second half of the 3rd century when he's saying this.
So there's a book by a Catholic bishop in the Renaissance, Francis de Sales.
Mm-hmm.
Have you heard of him?
He's a saint, a Catholic saint. Right?
Yeah. He wrote a book on the sign of the cross arguing that it's an apostolic practice, and it quotes mostly from this book, from this and other early documents.
Cool.
It's not very big like that. So.
Oh, I've never heard of that. That's cool. Yeah.
Didn't we read in some of our previous classes like it can make demons flee and burst into flames and things like that?
Maybe it makes them flee. I don't know about bursting into flames. Yeah, I mean, I think it's right. It's the idea is that this is the symbol of power that they recognize,
mm-hmm.
right?
I think I've heard,
yeah.
You know, when if an angel or some kind of spiritual being should ever appear to you, you know, we're taught you don't give it the time of day. But I've heard, you know, saying some things,
yeah.
I thought I heard that they'll test them sometimes by telling them to make the sign of the cross.
Yeah. Yeah, I've read that. And then sometimes what they'll do is that they'll just kind of go like this and they won't do the rest or something like that. Or, yeah, it's very interesting.
Is that kind of like asking if someone's a cop? Because you have to tell me if you are, right?
A cop? Oh, I don't know about that.
No, it's just a joke. Like a criminal will ask someone, are you a cop? Like,
oh.
You have to tell me.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what would be the best way to differentiate, like an actual, like, angel, like, any kind of apparition compared to, like, a demon? Because, like that example you gave, like, that demon pretending to be an angel, like, gave him, like, good advice up
yeah.
until that point. So how
yeah.
do you know?
Well, like Sarah said, what's been taught in the church is that you ask them to make the sign of the cross or pray the Our Father or something like that.
So it's just stuff like that, though?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because they won't do it. If they're demons, they won't do it. Yeah.
Aren't you also supposed to make the sign of the cross? Or no?
Well, you should, yeah, anyway. I mean, really, yeah. I mean, the safe thing is always to assume that any sort of spiritual vision, we should assume that it's demonic first. It's almost safer to assume that, really. Because there's a better chance that we're proud and deluded than that we're saints or something. So that's always the safe route.
Something on Orthodox Wiki.
Yeah.
That said the first mention of Christians making the sign of the cross is in the 2nd century by Tertullian.
Hmm. That's a very good source, yeah, so probably. He wrote a ton. Yeah.
So I've read that demons can't read the mind. So if they can't read the mind, how do they put thoughts in your head?
Well, they can't read your mind, but they can send thoughts to your mind. They can put them in your mind, but they can't know what's inside your mind. It's like one of those blue mailboxes on the sidewalk. They can put letters in, but
they can't take them out.
Yeah. I think that's the best way to think about it. Yeah. Yeah.
Because I was like, I've read like they can like make you feel certain things in different areas of your body. Like they could make you feel hungry or angry, like stimulate.
Maybe, yeah.
Some the temptations.
Maybe.
And so that made me think, like, are they able to like put in an electrical thing into your nervous system?
I don't know. We did hear that God allowed the demons to physically beat Saint Anthony earlier, which is not very common.
Well, they did all those things to Job too.
Yeah.
The boils and
the boils and stuff. Yeah.
Didn't God say that He let them do that to test him so that He could?
Yeah. So it's like God only allows them to do something if He knows that it will result in the person's victory. He only allows them to do something physical like that, in a sense. You know.
Going back to demons not being able to like read people's minds and things.
Yeah.
So I don't know, what, like 20 years ago or so, there was that guy that was going around, maybe he's still around, I don't know, that guy who was going around that, and he was on TV once in a while, where he would supposedly communicate with people's deceased loved ones, and they could communicate with that, you know. Jonathan Edwards? No.
Yeah, John Edwards.
John Edwards. And I always assumed that that was demonic.
Oh, for sure.
But...
yeah.
Then I like it now.
That happens in the Old Testament.
I just wonder how that works then, because you know he's like in a whole he's standing up front of a whole crowd of people and then he's like, oh, you know, I'm seeing like somebody who looks like this or says this and they're talking to somebody by this name or something and then people would be like, oh, that's me.
there could be plants in the crowd or what they could be doing is that they could be saying stuff that's generic enough.
Yeah.
That it.
So you're saying it's not demonic, it's just fake?
Or they could be demonic, yeah, sure.
Okay.
Because, the demons would know something about somebody's grandma who's the past. They could say, oh, this person has blonde hair and whatever.
I know that's the one big knock on the people that are mediums, is that they have plants or they have. You know, like in the crowd, they're so generic that it could be anybody's grandmother or grandmother.
Yeah, kind of.
It's pretty crazy though. My mom used to work with somebody who went to a psychic, and the psychic told this lady that she was going to have a son. She had two daughters, and she was going to have a son. And the lady kind of laughed it off because she was married, and she and her husband had taken steps to, you know, permanently not have children. Mm. And then turns out she. The son.
Oh,
you know, it's like so, and then she was like, "Wow, that's so cool." You know, I don't know. It's just so I always assume things like that.
Yeah, well,
are demonic, and but I don't know. I mean, I probably shouldn't even say this stuff. I try not to get too caught up in it because ultimately, you know, Christ has the victory, and if we're Christians, and then we don't have to worry about it.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we've got protection, but, it's just interesting to think about.
Well, I mean, you know, it's also, there's just a certain chance of being right or not, too, right? I mean, you can kind of guess. No, it is true, though. I mean, the demons, having so much experience, they are able to predict things very well. It's like somebody who predicts the stock market crashing, you know. They've experienced, and so they can predict that and get the right stocks in time and whatever.
I suppose. So maybe they could look at the history of our outward behavior.
It's like the Farmer's Almanac almost.
Like the Farmer's Almanac, yeah.
A little more accurate.
It will probably snow in February, you know, something like that, yeah. I mean, yeah. So.
Good chance you're going to get all the answers.
Yeah, well. We could end here. It's usually where we end here, so.